Huge asshole, and we're totally rooting for you. There was pity in her expression. My stomach tightened with nerves. All righty, ladies, Lindsay said, holding up her hands. Dawn is on its final approach, so someone start at the beginning. What the Sam hell is going on? The three girls glanced at one another again before Michelle, misery in her expression, looked back at Lindsay. It's the Ice Queen. Oh, shit, Lindsay murmured. Margot nodded. Lacey Sheridan's on her way to the house. My heart nearly stopped. That sickening feeling returned again, twisting my stomach and threatening to push back the pizza I'd eaten earlier. Not only had Ethan decided I wasn't worth the trouble, he'd already made arrangements to pick up the pieces of our stunted relationship with someone else. I didn't know how not to take that personally. Good Lord, Lindsay muttered. Hot or not, the boy has issues. I can't believe he'd ask her to come back here, Margot said, especially now. Especially now that he'd slept with me or broken up with me. The pity in Margot's voice brought hot tears to the edges of my lashes, but I blinked them back and looked up at the plastered ceiling to keep them from tracing down my cheeks. In that moment of weakness, when I was focused only on not crying in front of these virtual strangers, some of the walls that kept back the noise and sound began to tumble. The whispers I could no longer filter out began to circle around me. I belatedly realized we weren't the only vampires clustered together in the foyer, waiting for something to happen. Black-clad vampires stood in groups of three or four, some with heads together as they whispered, some with eyes on me, some with gazes out the front windows that flanked the front door. She's on her way to the house, someone said. What about Merritt? Asked someone else. I clenched my eyes shut. My name was being whispered around the room. There were 90 witnesses to the act now and to the request that Lacey get to Chicago as soon as goddamn possible. I opened my eyes again. I could feel my skin beginning to heat as humiliation and defeat gave way to that much more satisfying emotion, anger. Grief twisted into fury, and I could understand exactly how Selena's dismissal by some English beau could pull an emotional trigger, turning sadness outward into a spray of bitter shrapnel. I'm sure she wasn't the only woman or man in history for whom rejection had become fuel. That fire in the belly that moved her to action, to violence, to war, to destruction. The vampire ego was no less fragile than the human one. It was comforting, that anger, that ability to direct the emotion toward Ethan instead of seeing my rejection as my own failure. I closed my eyes as goosebumps lifted on my arms, my body sinking into the feeling as though into hot bathwater. When the room went silent, I opened them again. The girls had silenced their pity party, all heads turning as Ethan walked through the main hallway and past us toward the front door. She must be here, Margot muttered, and we turned to watch him move. She, I realized, must have been the reason for the phone call he'd received when he left the ops room, the reason he'd dismissed us. Ethan opened the door, then leaned forward to embrace a woman. Lacey, he said, thank you for coming on such short notice. His voice was warm, the implication of his words clear. He'd asked her here. She must have been the cool sorbet to my garlic sauce, the palate cleanser he needed after a night with me. I swallowed down a sudden bout of nausea. When he released her and stepped clear, then began shaking hands with the remainder of her entourage, I got my first look. She was tall and slender, her blonde hair cut into a sharp bob that ended just below her chin. Her face was model perfect. Straight long nose, wide mouth, blue eyes that held an icy sheen. She was dressed in a pale blue pantsuit that hugged her lean body. On her right hand was a single ring that carried an oversized pearl. She was beautiful, put together, elegant. She was everything he'd want. And she was here, in Chicago, from San Diego, because he'd asked her. The house looks lovely, Ethan. I like what you've done. He turned back to her and smiled, but as he turned his head to look over the room, As he caught sight of the knots of vampires in the hallway, his smile faded. He surveyed us, body tensing, and finally met my eyes. As we stared at each other, I wonder why he'd called her here, what succor he thought she could provide. I wondered why dating me would have been a sacrifice, but inviting back a former lover was not. I saw nothing in his eyes that would explain it, only a dose of shock that I'd caught him in the act. I don't know what I wanted to say to him, but I took a step forward, intent on telling him something. "Whoa, whoa," Lindsay said, moving to stand in front of me. "Don't go storming over there. You don't want to be that girl." I snorted, half the room's attention on me now. "What girl? The girl who got replaced within a matter of hours?" I fiercely whispered, then looked around the room. "They may not have known about the breakup, but the evidence is pretty clear. Is there anyone who doesn't think it now?" Margot, Catherine, and Michelle all looked away. "Mare," Lindsay said, putting her hands on my arms, "we're your friends, your fellow novitiates. But Ethan's a master, and so is Lacey. Embarrassing yourself in front of them would be a whole different level of humiliating." She had a point. Okay, I decided. I wouldn't confront him, but I also wouldn't hurt myself further by watching their interactions. I turned around and, without another word, took the stairs to the second floor. I went to my room and locked the door behind me. I didn't cry, wouldn't cry. Not again. I also wouldn't sleep. It being minutes before dawn, I changed into pajamas and climbed into bed. It had been a long night, but I lay awake, one arm behind my pillow, staring at the ceiling. Dawn was coming, the pull of it enticing my eyes to close, my brain to shut off. But the human part of me kept replaying the moments we'd shared, few though they were, and wondering if there was something I could have done, should have said, to give us a chance. I'd made myself vulnerable, and I was paying the price. But the real insult was that the entire house now knew, or would soon enough, about my being summarily dumped and replaced. Admittedly, I'd given him a chance, but that didn't mean I had to keep making bad decisions. I blew out a breath and swore off dating vampires. It was at that moment, ironically, that my would-be RG partner decided to give me a call. Assuming he was getting in touch because he'd heard from Luke about Conpac, I picked up my phone and flipped it open. "Merritt, it's Jonah," he said. "Are you ready for this thing tomorrow night?" I appreciated the concern in his voice, but I wasn't sure if it was directed at me on a personal level or because I was potentially an RG asset. "We've met the pack leaders, spent some time with the NAC, and seen schematics of the building. We have a communications plan, and you guys are backup." I shrugged. "That's as prepared as we can be." I skipped the details of the interaction that would have embarrassed Ethan. No point in both of us feeling miserable. Jonah offered a vague sound of agreement. "If I'm asked later, we never had this conversation. But I'm wondering if it is a time to request RG backup? To have guards on standby?" I couldn't get the words out fast enough. "This is definitely not that time. I appreciate the offer of support, but there are plenty of shifters out there who hate us. I'd seen that in action, firsthand. Sending in special ops and black helicopters isn't going to help. It will only fuel the fire. Trust me, we're in better stead than we might have been if we hadn't been at the bar, but we're not in by any means." He was quiet for a moment. "And if the shit goes down?" "Then Luke will call you in. You're a Red Guard, which means at that point you'd have the authority to make the decisions on their behalf. But you can't move early on this one. They think we're too political, untrustworthy. If we show up with extra vampires in tow, and without a crisis to justify it, we've proved their point. Let's go in assuming there'll be trouble that we can handle. And if things escalate into your jurisdiction, you can make the call." Another moment of consideration. "We'll stand by for now. Good luck." I hoped we wouldn't need it. Chapter 15, GOTV, Get Out the Vampire. Even as the sun descended again, I lay in bed for a good 15 minutes. Have you ever noticed that however uncomfortable you might have been when you first went to bed, the room too hot or too cold, the pillows not quite right, the mattress lumpy, the sheets scratchy, by the time you should get up, your bed has transformed itself into the platonic ideal of beds? The room is cool, the bed is soft, and the pillow may as well have been God's own headrest. The transformation inevitably happens, of course, when you're obligated to get up and out. When nothing sounds better than hunkering down in a pile of cool cotton, especially when facing your recent fling and his former lover is the other option. But even sentinels have to act like grown-ups, so I sat up and threw off the covers. It had been a good week since I'd gone for a run, since I had a couple of hours before we'd meet to go to the convocation. I pulled on a running bra, tank, and running shorts so I could kick out 3 miles through Hyde Park. Training with Ethan or the guards was a workout, certainly, but not the kind that loosened up your bones and mind, cleared away everything but the pounding of the pavement, the rhythm of your breathing, and a good old-fashioned sweat. But first, I needed some fuel for the gas tank. I wasn't ready to face down the rest of the vampires in the house, or risk the possibility of a Sheridan-Sullivan meeting. So I opted to avoid whatever drama might be awaiting me downstairs and scavenge breakfast on the second floor. I headed down the hallway and through a swinging door into the tiny rectangular kitchen. Granite-topped maple cabinets lined both sides of the room, and a refrigerator and other appliances were built into the cabinets in the same maple wood. The countertops held baskets of napkins and the like and smaller appliances. The refrigerator was covered in magnets and takeout menus from Chinese, Greek, and pizza places in Hyde Park. That was the advantage of living near U of C. The undergrads kept food delivery in business at all hours, and that was good for the rest of us. I went for the refrigerator and pulled it open. It wasn't unlike something you might have seen in an office building. A lot of leftover takeout, yogurt containers, and half-eaten desserts with initials marked on the top. It was all the detritus of prior vampires' meals and dates, labeled to keep other fangs away. But there were also house-supplied goodies, including lots and lots of blood in portable pint bags and smaller drink boxes. I took a second to appraise my need and decided it was time to stock up. I grabbed 2 drink boxes, shook and poked in the attached straw, sipped, and grimaced. Biting Ethan had been like drinking a rare vintage. Rich, complex, intoxicating. Drinking from a plastic box now tasted exactly like that. Flat, plasticky, sterile. It tasted dead somehow, as if the blood had lost the infusion of energy you got from drinking from the tap, so to speak. But since that particular supply had been cut off, I knocked it back, then did the same to the second box. This wasn't the time to let personal preference stand in the way of biological need, especially in light of the physical and emotional challenges I could be facing in a couple of hours. I tossed the empty boxes in the trash and, out of curiosity, opened a couple of the upper cabinets. They were stocked with healthy snacks, bags of granola, nuts, high-protein cereals, natural popcorn. "Belch," I muttered. Then closed the cabinet doors again and headed through the swinging kitchen door. When they stocked the cabinets with Twinkies, I'd be back. I made a note to talk to Helen, the house's den mother, about that. Breakfast in the bag, I headed outside. It was a warm and muggy June night. Not terribly late, but the streets were still quiet. I thought avoiding the paparazzi altogether risked making them a little too interested in vampire activities. So I headed down the street to the right and toward the group at the corner. I smiled and waved, flashbulbs snapping and popping as I moved nearer. "Hey," one called out. "It's the ponytailed Avenger." "Good evening, gentlemen. Any comment on the bar shooting, Merritt?" I smiled thoughtfully at the reporter, a youngish kid in jeans and a t-shirt, a laminated press badge around his neck. "Only that I hope the perpetrators are caught. Any comment on the stakings in Alabama?" he asked. My blood ran cold. "What stakings?" The man beside him, older, pudgier, with a mass of frizzy white hair and a similar mustache, gestured with his small reporter-style notebook. Four vamps were taken out at a, well, they're calling it a nest of vampires. Apparently part of some kind of underground anti-fang movement. Gabriel's concern about rumblings, then, had clearly been real. Maybe it was only an isolated incident. Maybe it was a horrible but random act of violence that didn't signal the turning of the tide for the rest of us. But maybe it wasn't. I hadn't heard, I said quietly, but my thoughts and prayers go to their friends and families. That kind of violence, that kind that grows from prejudice, is undefensible. The reporters were quiet for a moment as they scribbled down my comments. I should get going. Thanks for the update, gentlemen. They called out my name, trying to get in additional questions before I trotted off into the night. But I'd done my duty. I needed the run, the chance to clear my head before heading back into Cadogan House and the drama that undoubtedly awaited me there, political or otherwise. The first mile was uncomfortable, doable, especially as a vampire, but painful in the way first miles often were. But I eventually found a rhythm, my breathing and footfalls aligned, and made a circle around the neighborhood. I skirted U of C, the wound of no longer being enrolled in my would-have-been alma mater still a bit too raw. A breeze had stirred up by the time I made it back around to Cadogan House, and I nodded at the guards as I re-entered the grounds, trying to slow my breathing, hands on my hips. I had to run faster as a vampire to get my heart rate up, and I wasn't really sure how much good it did, but I felt better for having done it. It felt good to escape the confines of Cadogan House for a little while, to focus only on my speed and rhythm and kick. Figuring cleanliness was next on my to-do list, I went back to my room to grab a shower. I made it as far as my door. There was a smallish bulletin board on every dorm-like room in Cadogan House. A flyer was tacked to mine, a thick bit of cardstock bearing an announcement in fancy script letters. Greet the Master. Join us Saturday at 10 p.m. to welcome Lacey Sheridan, Master of Sheridan House. Cocktails and music. Casual attire. Rolling my eyes, I pulled the invitation off the door, then stepped back to glance down the hall. The same black and white flyer was posted on every door I could see. A GOTV effort that had nothing to do with voting or democracy. I wondered if this had been his idea. A chance to show the novitiates of Cadogan House whose team he was on? Maybe more important, how mandatory was something like this? Was I required to make an appearance? Toast Lacey Sheridan? Bring a gift? I crushed the card in my hand, then opened my door and stepped inside. But before I could close it again, I heard footsteps in the hallway. There were rarely vampires moving through this part of the building, so I nosily peeked through the crack and got an eyeful. Ethan and Lacey were walking side by side down the corridor. Ethan wore jeans and a snug, long-sleeved t-shirt in a pale, smoky green. His hair was pulled back, the Cadogan medal at his neck. The ensemble was casual enough that I assumed he'd be wearing it to the convocation. Lacey wore a gray tweed dress with a modern folded neckline and a pair of patterned black stilettos. Every strand of blonde hair was in place, and her makeup was as perfect as that of any airbrushed cover model. It should worry you, Lacey was saying. Meaning? Ethan asked. Sentinel or otherwise, she's common, Ethan. A common soldier. And I have to say, I really don't get all the fuss. My lips parted. Did she just call me common? I'm not sure that common is a word I'd equate with merit, Lacey. I don't deny she's a soldier, but I don't think common gives her due credit. Still, brawn doesn't make a master. Well, either she'll test one day or she won't. Lacey chuckled. You mean, you'll either nominate her or you won't. Lacey was the only other master vampire Ethan had nominated in his nearly 400 years as a vampire. He hadn't even taken testing. Masters like Ethan and Morgan, who'd risen to the ranks when their own masters were killed, were allowed to skip the exam. She sounded irritatingly confident that Ethan wouldn't nominate me. Admittedly, she's young, Ethan said. She has a lot of learning to do before she's ready. A lot of immortality to get through before she's ready. And only time will bear it out. But I believe she'll prove capable. He chose that moment to glance up and meet my eyes through the crack in the door. I made a split-second decision and pushed the door open as if I'd been on my way out. Ethan lifted his eyebrows in surprise. Mare, Sentinel. Lacey stepped behind him. I played innocent. Oh, hello. I was just on my way out. They both looked over my sweaty workout ensemble, and I felt like the heroine in a John Hughes movie. All awkwardness and deer in the headlights eyes. Out, he repeated. Think, I silently demanded, and when genius struck, I nodded, reached behind me, and pulled up my right foot, imitating a stretch. I just got in a run, so I was headed to the stairs to do some stretches. Ethan's brow furrowed, worry suddenly in his eyes. Did he care if I heard? Would it bother him if she'd hurt me? Are you going to introduce us? Lacey asked. For a split second, just enough for him to glimpse but not so long that she caught it, I tilted my head at him, letting him see the snarky question in my eyes. Yes, Ethan. Are you going to introduce us? Lacey Sheridan, she said, not letting Ethan make the choice. She didn't extend a hand, but just stood there smugly, as if the mere mention of her name was supposed to knock me back a couple of pegs. Merritt, Sentinel, I added, in case she needed the reminder that I was the one in Ethan's house now. I bit back a smile at the twitch in her jaw. I was a guard as well, she said, her gaze scanning my body as she sized me up, an opponent preparing to do battle. Were we battling for Ethan? For some kind of in-house superiority? Whatever the reason, I wasn't going to play the game. I'd already gone all in, and I'd lost my entire stack of chips in the bargain. That's what I've heard, I politely said. I'm friends with Lindsay. You two were guards together, I understand, before you took testing. Yes, I know Lindsay. She's a solid guard, particularly good at ferreting out motivations. She offered Lindsay's evaluation as if, rather than discussing a friend or colleague, she'd been asked for a professional reference. I shifted my gaze back to Ethan. I assume you heard about Alabama. His expression clouded. I did. Gabriel's rumblings? I nodded. That was my guess. He blew out a breath, then nodded. It is what it is. I'd like to leave for the church within the hour. Liege, I said again, obedience in my voice. He didn't growl exactly, but the acquiescence clearly irritated him. I smiled as I walked away. I was showered and dressed, jeans, boots, and a tank top beneath my leather jacket, and on my way downstairs to Ethan's office when my phone rang. I pulled it from my pocket and checked the screen. It was Mallory. Yo, I answered. I know you're heading out, but I'm about to pull up in front of Cadogan House. Catcher wants to talk to Ethan, and I have something for you. Something tasty? Do you only love me for my choice cooking? Well, no, but I'll admit it's one of the reasons. As long as the reasons are many and varied, get your butt down here. Knowing when to take an order, I closed and repocketed the phone, then completed my trip to the front door. The foyer was master vampire free, so I headed outside with a pleasant lack of drama. Mal stood at the front gate in stovepipe jeans and a long tank, hands at her hips. She looked to be interrogating the guard. I hopped down the steps, then took the sidewalk to the gate. Catcher stepped beside her just as I approached, probably having just parked the car. A mix of amusement and defeat in his expression. And I've heard you folks are really great at the third key, she was saying. Do you have any advice for me? The mercenary fairy at the gate stared down at her with maliciousness in his eyes. You folks... Mallory grinned. Sorry, it's just your traditions are so interesting. So natural, so woodsy. Would you be willing to sit down with me and maybe you could share? Okay, Catcher interrupted, putting his hands on her shoulders and turning her toward the house. That's enough of that. My apologies, he offered to the guard, and guided Mallory up the sidewalk. "Making new friends?" I asked her. "They're really fascinating people. I bet they like being called by their names." Mallory slid Catcher a flat stare. "Do you know his name?" He looked at me. I shrugged. "I just work here." Speciesism among supernaturals really is the last bastion of acceptable prejudice in this country, Mal said, then seemed to realize I was dressed in leather and holding my sword. "You look ready to chase down some shifters." "Let's hope it doesn't come to that. You're not in Schaumburg tonight?" She shook her head. "I have a practicum again tonight, which means I'm supposed to be at home making potions and whatnot." "Good luck with that." "Good luck with your shifters, and that's why I'm here." She stuck her fingers into the snug pocket at her hip and fished around. "Hold out your hand." I arched a skeptical eyebrow, but did as I was directed. Mallory fished something out, then deposited it into my palm. It was an antique bracelet, a gold link chain, dark from wear, that bore a circular locket. I held it up. The image of a bird was engraved in the top. "It's an apotrope," she proudly said.
"It's a what?"
"Apotrope. It's a charm for good luck, to ward off bad juju." She leaned forward and pointed at the inscription. "That's a raven, a symbol of protection. I found the bracelet in a shop in the Scandinavian district." I frowned at her, puzzled.
"Chicago has a Scandinavian district?"
"Nope," Catcher said. "But the store was next door to a restaurant that sold pickled herring. She decided that was the Scandinavian district. First you're moving furniture, then you're moving neighborhoods." "I'm an up-and-comer," she said. "Anywho, I worked a little second key action of my own, and there you go." "Well, that was very thoughtful, even without the gratuitous urban planning. Thanks, Mal." She shrugged. "I wanted to give you a tincture of Wolfsbane, but Party Pooper over here said no."
"Wolfsbane?" I asked, looking between them.
"It's poisonous to shifters," Catcher said, mid-eye roll. I nodded in understanding. "Yeah, might be bad form to wear wolf poison to a shifter convocation."
"I only would have put a little in there," Mallory said. "Not enough to give anyone a stomach ache, much less actually kill somebody.
And nobody has to know about it." "Still better to stick with the raven. Thank you for bringing it." I held out my right wrist so she could clasp on the bracelet, but I glanced up when Catcher made a low whistle of warning.
"Company," he said, and since his gaze was on the door, I guessed who that might be.
"Ooh, she's pretty," Mal whispered, looking up once she'd secured the bracelet. "Who is she?" "That would be Lacey Sheridan."
Mallory blinked at me. "Lacey Sheridan? The vampire Ethan?"
I interrupted her with a nod.
"Were you going to let me know that his former girlfriend was in town?
I figured you'd already had a good dose of merit humiliation for the week."
She patted my arm. "Don't be silly. Vampire humiliation is like a fine wine. It should be shared between friends."
I stuck out my tongue, but Catcher shook his head.
"Here they come," he warned. "Put on your happy face."
I plastered on a fake smile and turned to greet them. His katana in one hand, he used the other to gesture toward Lacey.
"Mallory Carmichael and Catcher Bell," he said. "Catcher, I believe you and Lacey met when she was in the house."
"Yep,"
that was all Catcher said. He didn't bother extending a hand. "It's nice to see you again, Catcher."
He barely acknowledged the greeting, and my heart warmed. Catcher was gruff, sure, but that didn't usually involve outright snubbing people, at least in my experience. I may have given him and Mallory a lot of crap about their naked shenanigans, but he knew which team he was on.
"Mallory is Merritt's former roommate," Ethan told Lacey, "and a newly identified sorceress. She is currently training with an order representative in Schaumburg."
Lacey cocked her head.
"I thought the order didn't have representatives in the Chicago area."
Mallory put a hand on Catcher's arm before he could growl at Lacey, but you could see the urge to step forward in his expression. Catcher had been kicked out of the order under circumstances that weren't altogether clear to me.
but the lack of an order office in Chicago had something to do with it. That's a long story, Mallory said, and it's nice to meet you. She glanced at Ethan. Are you going to take good care of my girl tonight? I always take care of my vampires. Mallory smiled sweetly. All evidence to the contrary. Catcher put a hand on Mallory's shoulder and looked gravely at Ethan. We actually came by here for a reason other than skewering you, and it's not good news. A body was found in a warehouse about 8 blocks from the bar. It was Tony. Ethan blew out a slow breath. I'm bothered by that on a number of levels, not the least of which is the fact that he was our prime suspect. He still could have been behind the hit, I pointed out, but someone else might not have been happy about that, or wanted to keep him quiet. Catcher nodded. At the very least, there's more than one person involved in whatever shifter mess is going on. Does Gabriel know? Ethan asked. Catcher nodded. Jeff made the call a little earlier. This is not the kind of information I like having 2 hours before the convocation. No, Catcher agreed. It's not. And it's probably not the last of your problems tonight.
I'd expect trouble, Lacey said, apparently joining the conversation.
It's highly unlikely the first attack was random, and since the perpetrators haven't managed to forestall the meeting, I'd predict that a second strike is imminent. We've arranged backup, Ethan said, but his gaze was on the lawn, his expression blank, as if he were contemplating unpleasant things. Guards from Gray and Navarre. We'll have communications open.
Best you can do, Catcher said.
We stood there for a moment, all of us probably wondering what the night had in store. I'm going to let Lacey get settled in so she can work from my office while we're away, Ethan said, glancing at me. Meet me at the first floor stairs in 5. Liege, I said, dipping my head with perfectly graceful condescension. His upper lip curled in dissatisfaction, but after a wave to Mallory and Catcher and some awkward goodbyes between Lacey and Mallory, he escorted Lacey back down the sidewalk. Liege? Catcher repeated. I bet I could count on one hand how many times I've heard you say that.
I'm opting for acquiescent, I said, my gaze still on the masters.
Catcher grinned a bit evilly. I bet that's pissing him off. I gave him a grin. I think he hates it, which makes it all the more enjoyable. And since he's wanted Merritt the acquiescence since the day you stepped foot in Cadogan House, Mallory pointed out, it's not even immature. You're just giving him what he asked for.
Precisely, I agreed with a nod, although I didn't entirely agree. It was fun, sure, and appropriate in its way, but still immature.
You know, Mallory said, her head tilted as she watched them walk. She's all blonde and fusty, like an attorney or something. And that's not a compliment.
Bloodsuckers, either way, Catcher muttered.
I patted his arm. You know, that was very sweet what you did, being snarky to Little Miss Sunshine.
Don't get too excited. It's not that I'm on your side, Catcher said, then nodded toward Mallory. But I'd be sleeping on the couch for a week if I didn't take her side.
And my side is your side, Mallory concluded, then held out her hands.
We need to run. I need to start cooking. You be good tonight, okay?
I stepped forward and embraced her, then stepped back again.
I'll be as good as possible, and I'd ask the same thing of you two. I gave them my best motherly stare.
Catcher snorted. If we're not playing Naked Twister, we're wasting our waking hours.
Yep, Mallory said as she tugged him down the sidewalk.
That's the love of my life. He's a romantic at heart.
True to his word, Ethan met me in the lobby 5 minutes later, sans the master of Sheridan House. But he was followed by Luke and Malik. Luke was in jeans and a white t-shirt. Malik, tall, dark-skinned, and green-eyed, wore black suit pants, square-toed black shoes, and a crisp, white button-up shirt. The top button of his shirt opened to reveal his Cadogan medal. Malik, the only married vampire in my acquaintance, was also one of the most handsome. Shaved head, wide, clear eyes, sharp cheekbones. But he had the most solemn countenance of any vampire I'd met.
I believe we're ready, Ethan said, glancing between them. Malik, the house is left in your care and trusting. Luke, check in with our ground team. God willing, the need of them won't prove necessary. But just in case. It's done, Luke said. We liaised earlier, and we're all in contact. Gray and Navarre are on standby. You both have your earpieces. Like obedient students, we pulled out our earpieces, which we'd both stashed in our pockets, and showed them to Luke. Good children, he said with a chuckle. You don't need to put them in until you're on site. You might want to do that in a private moment and not with shifters breathing down your necks, lest they think we're even more conniving than they already believe we are. When you get them in, we'll be on the other end. Do you want me to try Darius again? We all turned to Malik. Darius was the head of the Greenwich Presidium, the Western European Council. Ethan shook his head. Not now. We've tried to reach him once, and he didn't get back to us. At this point, it's better to ask forgiveness later than permission now. You think he might say no? I asked. Ethan slid me a glance. I think the GP is unpredictable in its current form. We tell them we're liaising with shifters, that we're offering strategic support to hundreds of shifters, and we push the GP panic button. We invite a shitstorm, Luke translated. I nodded my understanding. Ethan blew out a breath. If you're all comfortable with your respective stations, we'll head out. Good luck, Luke said, then gave me a pat on the shoulder. Kick ass, Sentinel. I'm really hoping it doesn't come to that. That makes two of us, Ethan said. He and Malik whispered something together. The act was probably one of the rituals related to Ethan's leaving the house in Malik's care. Then took the stairs to the basement. Chapter 16. The Big Bad Wolves. We drove to Ukrainian village in silence. When we arrived, Ethan pulled the Mercedes into a slot on the street. We were early for Conpac, but it was still late on a Friday night for the rest of the neighborhood, which is quiet and mostly empty of traffic. We got out of the car, buckled on our katanas, and walked toward St. Bridget's, which was well lit by streetlights and spotlights in the landscaping. I stopped for a moment to gaze up at the cathedral. Cathedral was definitely an appropriate moniker. St. Bridget's was a gorgeous building, with peach-colored stone and a handful of towers topped by turquoise domes that look like ski hats. A giant stained-glass window was set into the front of the building, its three rectangular panels showing a pastoral scene of trees and butterflies, a faun reclining peacefully in the middle. The church was an architectural jewel in the midst of the working-class neighborhood, like a lost remnant from an ancient fairy tale, a page that history forgot to turn, transported from the deep woods of Eastern Europe to the west side of Chicago. It was, however, very much like the neighborhood around it in one respect. It was very, very quiet. It's not that I expected picketers and protests, but from what we'd seen before, shifters weren't the type to go gently into that good night. I maintain it's weird they're meeting in a church, I said. It is unusual, Ethan said beside me. But it isn't our call to make. We stood there in silence for a moment, long enough that I glanced over at him. I found his gaze on me. What? I asked. He gave me a flat look. We're here on business. I want the air to be clear. The air is as clear as it's going to get. We made a mistake. We've both since remedied it, so let's move on, shall we? A mistake? He actually had the gall to sound surprised at my answer, but I didn't buy it. He hadn't used the word mistake in his post-Breckenridge guilt party, but that's pretty much what he said. A mistake, I repeated. Can we get back to work? Merritt, he began, regret in his voice, but I held up a hand. His guilt wasn't going to make me feel any better. Let's get to work. We took the stairs to the slate of doors that spanned the front of the church. I assumed this is where people gathered after services, maybe shaking hands with the clergy, maybe making plans for dinner or lunch. The doors were unlocked and opened into a small receiving room, the walls of which bore signs directing parishioners toward children's care rooms and morning coffees.
We pushed through a second set of doors, and I gaped at the sight before us, walking inside past Ethan to take in the full view. The church's exterior was impressive, but that was nothing compared to the interior. The sanctuary was like a treasure chest, with floors of gleaming stone, walls of stained glass, gold-framed icons, gilded alcoves and frescoes. Gleaming columns and ornate brass latticework marked the church aisles. Robin, Jason, Gabriel, and Adam stood at the front of the sanctuary. But it was Berna who first got our attention. "You will eat," she said, stepping in front of us, a disposable aluminum pan in her outstretched arms. The pan was covered with foil, but it steamed with heat, and I could smell what was inside. Meat, cabbage, spices. Eastern European deliciousness. "You take," she said, and shoved the pan, still hot, into my arms. "I appreciate the sentiment, but you don't have to keep feeding me." She clucked her tongue. "Too thin," she said, then reached out two knobby fingers and pinched my arm, hard. "Ow!" "No meat," she said, disapproval in her voice. "No meat on bones, you don't find man." Then she cast an appraising glance at Ethan, one bottle blonde eyebrow raised. "You are, man." Not that I disagreed, but she was making the wrong match. "Thank you, Berna," I said, hoping to draw her attention back to me and distract her from her love connecting. Slowly, as if guessing my game, she glanced back at me, then gave me an up and down appraisal that was none too flattering. After clucking her tongue again, she walked around us and disappeared into the lobby. I glanced over at Ethan and proffered the cabbage rolls. "Should I just put this in your car while we're here?" He blanched, apparently not crazy about the idea that his Mercedes would smell like the back room of a Ukrainian pub. "Good evening, vampires." I turned to find Adam grinning at the pan in my hands. He was dressed simply. Plaid button-up over gray t-shirt and jeans over heavy black boots, but that didn't diminish the wolfish appeal. "Good evening," I held out the pan. "She keeps pushing food at me." "That's Berna. That's her way of showing affection." Not from my physique, apparently. That notwithstanding, I still had a steaming pan to deal with. "Is there somewhere I could put this for a few hours?" "You think holding a pan of cabbage rolls will interrupt your vampire mojo?" "It will make it a little harder to swing my sword." "Well, we wouldn't want that," he said coyly. "I'll take you to the kitchen and you can drop it off there. Also gives you a chance to see a little more of the church."
"Thanks."
"I'll wait here," Ethan silently said. "I'd like to talk to Gabriel about Tony."
"Good luck," I offered back, wondering whether the fight at the Brex was truly water under the bridge or whether Gabe was going to hold it against us. On the other hand, he hadn't changed his mind about our providing security, so he must have been comfortable enough.
"Keep your guard up."
"Liege," I dutifully answered back.
I followed Adam down the aisle on the left side of the church, offering Gabriel and Jason a wave as I passed. He moved through a door and into the side wing Luke had showed us earlier. It was obvious we'd moved from the original architecture to the 1970s renovation, where the chapel was luxurious. The side wing was straight-lined and kind of sterile. Function had won out over form here, from the industrially carpeted floors to the cinder block walls. But as we passed the nursery rooms, it became clear that the parishioners were less concerned about what the church looked like than what went on there. I stopped at an open door and glanced inside. Drawings and educational posters decorated the walls. Toddler-sized tables and chairs dotted the room, and the warm stuffed animals and wooden blocks were stacked neatly on a windowsill.
"They're a tight community," Adam said beside me.
"I can tell." When we'd both looked our fill, Adam continued down the hallway, then turned into an industrial-style kitchen clearly meant for preparing meals for a big, hungry congregation. He held open the door of the refrigerator while I slid the pan onto a shelf. That done, he closed the door again, then leaned against one of the stainless steel islands in the middle of the room. I spied a bulletin board on the facing wall and walked over for a better look. A sign-up sheet for an after-church luncheon was posted beside a flyer for a canned food drive. Get a little, give a little, I thought. And speaking of getting a little, I decided to take the opportunity to learn a little more about Adam and his crew. I started with the geography. So, I was just curious. Why Ukrainian village? What's your connection to this neighborhood? Shifters? I nodded. We have roots in Eastern Europe. Our families are tight-knit. You put the two together, you get Ukrainian village. Huh, I said. That's interesting. He arched his eyebrows at me. Is it interesting? Or are you just making nice to do your part for a vampire shifter alliance? He spoke the words with sarcasm, but there was a thread of something more in his voice. Irritation? Anger? Disgust? I wasn't sure if that was animosity toward vampires or toward politics generally, but both were shifter-esque emotions. Not wanting to fight it out, I mimicked that negligent shrug he'd given earlier. Just making friendly conversation. Nothing wrong with that, is there? A twinkle in his eye, he answered back. No, ma'am. There most definitely is not. We chatted a little longer, just enough for me to feel him more. I'd anticipated getting some of the youngest brother of a pack leader vibe, and while he was quite the smartass, he seemed earnestly concerned about the pack. I'm nervous about tonight, he admitted as we took the hallway back to the main chapel. It's not that I think Gabe couldn't handle whatever popped up, but I'd prefer we keep things as violence-free as possible. Any thoughts on the culprit for the bar shooting? He shook his head, his expression tightening. He was holding back. I heard Tony. I wasn't sure how to finish the sentence, so I didn't. His death changes things, Adam said, but I don't know if that means he was behind the attack. We had the same thought. Adam frowned. It's just that a planned assassination isn't a very pack thing to do. Crime of passion, sure, but not an assassination. It's a little, maybe, vampire? I arched a suspicious eyebrow. Anti-vampire prejudice wasn't really the vibe I wanted right now. I was much too outnumbered. And speaking of prejudice, I asked, has Gabriel said anything about the incident at the Brex? Adam chuckled mirthlessly. The incident with Ethan? I nodded. Well, he wasn't thrilled about the disruption, but I think he was more amused by the whole thing. I crossed my arms over my chest. Amused? Adam shrugged. They've known each other for a while. Gabe knows Sullivan to be cold, calm, calculated. And that was definitely not cold, calm, or calculated. Gabe figures Sullivan has it pretty bad for you. You'd be surprised, I said dryly. The vibration of my cell phone saved me from further elaboration. I pulled it out of my pocket and glanced at the screen. It was a text message, but not from Luke or Malik or the Katagun guards. It was from Nick, and it wasn't good. Tip says contract on top dog, hit imminent, the message read, was signed NB. I stopped in the middle of the hallway, my heart suddenly pounding. We'd been right. Whoever the culprit, the violence wasn't limited to the attack on the bar. Someone meant to take out Gabriel, with or without Tony. I glanced up at the door to the chapel in front of me. I needed to tell Ethan and Gabriel, but first I wanted facts. If Nick had information, a source, a time, anything, I wanted to hear it from his lips before I took it to the men who doubt its veracity the most. The vampire and shifter who were already suspicious of Nick. I glanced up at Adam, who stopped a few feet away, his head cocked as he looked at me. Everything okay? I hitched a thumb back toward one of the nursery rooms. Okay if I use a room for a couple of minutes? I need to make a quick call. Something up? I faked nonchalance, no sense sounding the alarms until I had proof in hand. Not really, but it's time sensitive. It took a few seconds, but he finally nodded. Help yourself. You can meet us back in the chapel when you're done. I smiled brightly. Thanks, Adam, and thanks for the chat. You're very welcome, kitten. Anytime you want to do more chatting, Gabriel knows how to reach me. For now, the key was reaching Nick. Turns out, reaching Nick wasn't that difficult. Once I was in one of the nursery rooms with the door shut, I simply dialed back the number that sent the text message, and he answered on the first ring. Breckenridge. Nick, it's Merritt. That was fast. Seemed important, what with the death threat and all. What did you hear? Someone called the paper's tip line and asked for me specifically. I frowned. So they knew enough not to spill the details about shifters to the switchboard guy. That was my first thought, too. He must have been a shifter, but I couldn't tell who. You know those voice manipulators that kidnappers use in the movies to change the pitch of their voices? This guy had one. What did he say? The message was short and simple. I heard the shuffling of paper as if Nick were flipping through a notebook. He said the shots at the bar weren't an accident. He said someone issued a contract on Gabriel, and the second attempt is supposed to take place tonight. In a church full of shifters? Not exactly a quiet way to take someone out. Yeah, a tip for the uninitiated. At some point, it will be chaos in there. I don't think a gunshot, even a hit at close range, would be that hard to accomplish.
Well, that information would have been useful before today.
Anything else? That was it, except for one more thing, he said, then paused. Building drama, I thought, like any good writer. He said to find the culprit, we had to check the top of the packs. You heard they found Tony? Yeah, but that doesn't mean he wasn't involved. He had the opportunity. It was his bike they found. And he may have had motive, too.
Such as?
Installing someone else in Gabriel's seat. Maybe attempting a consolidation of the packs. It wouldn't be the first time. Or maybe the simplest possibility. Scaring everybody back to Aurora.
Something else is weird, you know.
What?
The tip, I said. Think about it.
Someone learned Gabriel was in trouble, and they have the forethought to call you, but they use a device to disguise their voice. Maybe they were afraid of being caught.
By calling an anonymous tip line?
If you have the information, you're probably close enough to the crime to be a part of it. Or maybe they knew you'd recognize their voice.
We both considered that quietly for a moment.
I think it would be better if you didn't tell them the tip came from me, he finally said.
I knew why he wanted to remain anonymous. The Brecks were still on the outs with the pack. They were trying to get back in, certainly. But learning that Nick was the information source about a hit was only going to make Gabe more suspicious. On the other hand, I'm a vampire, Nick. If someone has information like that, why are they going to tell me?
Because you're the ponytailed avenger.
I'm hardly capable of avenging anyone, and as you pointed out, I'm a vampire. It's not like my helping Berna brought everyone into the vampire camp. I blew out a breath.
I'll tell Gabe it was anonymous, but if Ethan asks, I'm not going to lie to him.
Nick was quiet for a moment.
Deal, he finally said. Are you coming tonight? We aren't. We've given proxies to other members of the pack. It's a symbolic thing. Another way to make reparations.
Well then, I suppose I'll see you later.
Or I won't, I allowed, in case the vote necessitated a shifter retreat. Good luck, he said solemnly, and the line went dead. Information in hand, I trotted back to the chapel to find Ethan. There were more shifters in the pews now, and a few milling about with sound equipment and clipboards. Like the American pack leaders, they were all men, except for Fallon Keene, who stood at the front of the chapel in a snug, long-sleeved black shirt, a short, pleated black skirt, and knee-high military-style boots, her suspicious gaze on the congregation. I found Ethan in the back of the room with Gabriel, the two of them alone in a corner, standing side by side, their gazes on the crowd. They both looked up as my boot heels clacked against the stone floors. Sentinel? Ethan silently asked. I didn't answer. This one needed to be spilled to both of them. I decided it was best to stick as close to the truth as possible. I got a call, I said when I reached them. There was no caller ID, and the caller used one of those voice disguising deals. I looked at Gabriel.
He said there was a contract hit on you, and it was supposed to go down tonight.
He closed his eyes for a moment.
It's not that I'm surprised, but that's damn inconvenient timing. Violence begets violence, and I don't want more trouble because someone thinks they can best the Apex. I don't want that spilling out and affecting the vote. The pack needs to be here. The decision needs to be made, and by them.
Ethan frowned, that familiar line of worry between his eyes.
What precisely did the caller say?
Just what I said. That there's a hit on Gabriel, and that the hit's going down tonight, imminent, I added.
I think he said imminent.
I can't, won't cancel CONPAC. The packs are coming here tonight with shit on their minds. We can't just dismiss that. Just send all that pent-up energy back into the universe with no outlet. That would be a very bad idea for the packs and the city.
Given the earnestness of his voice and the electric buzz that was beginning to stir in the chapel as the audience began to grow, I took him at his word. We didn't need a few hundred frustrated shifters running around Chicago.
We understand your position, Ethan said, and we commend your devotion to your people. But the continuity of the convention isn't the only issue. They take you out and they disrupt the balance of power.
No, completely alter the balance of power. Those implications are equally bad.
If Ethan was being that frank, I guessed he and Gabriel had worked through any lingering tension.
What do you propose? Gabriel said.
Given our limited amount of time, as many precautions as we can take, Ethan said.
Not to be morbid, but if they try a hit, any thoughts on likely scenarios?
The debate can get rowdy. It's not impossible they'd try to take advantage of that chaos, make a move in the middle of it.
Then we'll stick by you when the convocation begins. We know you're strong, but you aren't immortal. As Merritt has demonstrated, we can take hits you can't.
I'm not sure insulting me is the way to go here, Gabriel muttered.
You know what I meant, Ethan said. Who in the sanctuary do you trust?
Gabriel scanned the crowd for a moment.
Fallon. I trust Fallon.
Even though she's next in line for the pack behind you?
Ever so slowly, Gabriel turned his head toward me, his gaze suddenly menacing.
Are you accusing Fallon of something, Sentinel?
Magic, astringent and sharp, electrified the air.
I kept my eyes on Gabriel, my expression neutral, as if I were staring down an attacking dog.
I'm accusing no one. I am, however, playing devil's advocate for the purpose of ensuring your safety. Tonight, that's my job.
It took a few seconds for the magic to dissipate, but he finally nodded.
Ethan put a hand at my back. We're going to take a walk around the church, get a sense of whether anything is out of the ordinary. We'll talk to Fallon on the way out. Stay within her line of sight while we're gone.
Is he always this bossy, Sentinel?
You have no idea.
Be that as it may, Ethan said. Do us a solid and keep yourself alive for the time being.
At Gabriel's nod, we walked toward Fallon's corner.
Sometimes, Ethan whispered as we moved, the work of protecting others is in convincing them they need protection in the first place.
Chapter 17, Political Animals. Fallon didn't look in our direction as we approached, but from the set of her shoulders and the scanning gaze, I had no doubt she knew exactly where we were. We stayed at her side, ensuring she had a clear view across the sanctuary.
We're going to take a walk around, Ethan told her. Gabriel suggested he trusted you to keep an eye on him in the meantime.
Fallon slid him a glance.
My brother said that?
He did.
Huh, she said, her face suddenly brightening with pleasure.
That makes for a nice change.
Feel free to take a walk around. I have things in hand here.
From the altered currents of magic around her body, a signal she wore weapons, plural, of honed steel.
I bet she did.
Ethan nodded at her, then moved toward the sanctuary door. But Fallon wasn't done with us.
You're friends with Jeff, right?
I stopped and glanced back at her. He's a good friend, yeah.
She nibbled the edge of her lip. What's his status, you know, girlfriend-wise? I had to work to bite back a smile.
Single. You should take a stab at him.
She lifted her nose and looked back at the crowd. Lots going on tonight.
That is true, I said, then looked over at the doorway to the side wing of the church where Ethan stood, waiting for me.
But having a partner in a crisis can be a big help.
Anyway, we'll be back in a few minutes.
Noted.
We exchanged a nod, and I joined my own partner again. As we moved into the side wing, the air pressure changed. I belatedly realized magic was fully buzzing in the chapel. Much like the frog in the soup pot, I hadn't even noticed until we'd stepped away. I told Ethan about the buildup as we moved down the hallway.
Is it just magic? He asked. Or is it steel as well?
I frowned. I'm not sure I could separate it out. Probably both.
Probably, he agreed, then pointed toward the doors that led off from the main hallway.
What are these?
Classrooms, nurseries.
Unlikely spots for the making of assassination plans.
You'd think, if someone's going to make an attempt toward Gabe, they've probably done the planning somewhere else.
I pointed toward the last door.
The one on the end is the kitchen.
He stopped, turned in a half circle, and perused the hallway, his gaze tripping over the handouts, children's art, and religious posters.
Anything of interest there? Does my pan of cabbage rolls count?
He made a sarcastic sound.
Only for you, Sentinel. And now that we're out of Gabriel's hearing, is there anything you'd like to tell me about your anonymous phone call?
Are you suggesting I didn't tell you the whole truth?
He gave me